dated a woman who could fill out a double D cup bikini. If every man who fit that description was a killer, I was in trouble. The whole alibi thing, I don't know how he pulled that off, she admitted. What was his alibi anyway?
He said he was with a client all day.
You know he's a prominent lawyer here, at one of the big Atlanta firms.
Yes, he told me that. God, I can't believe you spoke to Tank, that arrogant, lying pig,
spat Cheryl. She took a moment to collect herself. Anyway, his story was that he was in his office downtown with a client at the time the murders were committed. The client backed him up. It was, what was his name? A banker or something. Some sort of businessman.
So your theory is that they were both lying?
Sinclair and his banker client, too?
I don't know. I just know I know this, Caroline. It was Tank Sinclair that killed your mama and daddy.
Beamer Beasley was right. Cheryl's theories sounded harebrained. They wouldn't stand up in court for 5 minutes. Certainly not against a silver-haired, silver-tongued attorney such as the man she was accusing. So why was I now sitting here, turning things over in my head, going back over every word I had exchanged over scrambled eggs and sriracha sauce with Ethan Sinclair?
I'm not sure how this changes anything, said Beamer Beasley, when I tracked him down buying waffle fries at a Chick-fil-A on Howell Mill Road. I mean, I know your mama's ex-neighbor thinks Ethan Sinclair did it. She's been yammering on about it for 34 years.
I really wish you had told me that, I complained. All you said was that Sadie Rawson might have had an affair. You never mentioned his name.
You never asked, he barked down the phone line. Last thing I want to do is drag a respectable man's name through the mud, drag him into Ms. Rooney's loony conspiracy theories. Ethan and Betsy Sinclair are well regarded here. He's on the board of directors of the Alliance Theater and the Atlanta Botanical Garden. He organizes an annual golf tournament to benefit veterans, for God's sake.
He said he didn't do it. He has an alibi. We checked it out. There is nothing to indicate he was at the Smiths' house that day. End of story. Frankly, he was probably out of your mama's league.
I bridled at this last comment, but held my tongue. Was he one of the suspects who had a gun? I demanded instead.
Was he what?
Last week you told me that back in 1979 you questioned two suspects who owned guns. Was Ethan Sinclair one of the two?
Ms. Cashin.
Beasley sounded weary. Call me Caroline for Pete's sake.
With your permission, I'll stick with Cashin. Police protocol. To do with respect and professional distance and all that. And to answer your question,
doesn't matter. I think I already know the answer. Do me a favor, though. Check where Sinclair was last Wednesday night. The night my house got broken into. 39. Thursday, October 31st, 2013. My mother arrived before 9, bearing lasagna, 2 deep pans of it, 1 sausage and 1 spinach. What I was in fact craving for breakfast was a croissant jambon fromage from Pâtisserie Poupon. If I'd known she was driving over, I would have asked her to pick one up on her way. I wouldn't have said no to a Vicodin either. I now regretted having told Dr. Gellert not to bother refilling my painkiller prescription. Last night I had tossed and turned in bed, feeling as though 1,000 tiny needles were stabbing my neck. I decided to view this not as a setback, but as a positive development. The numbness must be receding. My skin and nerves were knitting back together. Still,
This morning I was tired and sore. I was also worried. The photos of Ethan Sinclair were unsettling. During the night, as I'd writhed around on my mattress trying to escape the needle knives, I had homed in on the weirdest part of my breakfast with him. He had denied knowing Sadie Rawson well. He had presented himself as a tennis buddy, closer to Boone. But Cheryl Rooney had told me that Ethan and his wife socialized with my birth parents. Even if Cheryl was flat wrong about there having been an affair, even if she was loony, as Beasley seemed to think, I'd seen the beach photo myself. Sadie Rawson resplendent in a bikini. There isn't a beach within 100 miles of Atlanta. At the very least, they'd all taken a weekend trip to the coast together. Why had Sinclair lied? With supreme effort, I put a smile on my face. Mom was burrowed into my freezer, trying to clear space for one of her lasagnas. "Your freezer is packed to the gills," she muttered. "What is all this stuff?" "Here, let me help." I squeezed past her and started rearranging Tupperware tubs of chicken soup. My mom stood watching. All of a sudden, she squealed. "You're using your right hand!" I looked down in surprise. It was true. I was throwing frozen soup blocks around as though it caused me no trouble at all. Tentatively, I stretched my right arm straight and rotated my wrist in a full circle clockwise, then counterclockwise. I hadn't been able to do that for more than a year. Mom and I grinned at each other. "I'm going to call your father," she said. "He'll be thrilled." I headed upstairs to change out of my pajamas. When I returned 20 minutes later, teeth brushed and hair twisted back in a bun, she was seated on my living room sofa. Cheryl's photos were still spread across the coffee table. My mom had picked up one by the edges and was studying it intently, a strange look on her face. I thought I understood. Had Mom ever seen a photograph of Sadie Rawson? She must be upset. The resemblance to me was staggering. She waved the photo at me. "Mom, darling," she said, "I didn't know you knew Ethan." 40. My mouth hung open. I thought my legs might buckle. I steadied myself on the arm of the sofa. "What are you talking about?" "I didn't know you knew Ethan. Such a lovely man." "You've met him?" "Of course. We've known Ethan and Betsy for years. We got to know each other at the ABA convention. Let's see, the time it was in Dallas." The ABA was the American Bar Association. That must have been, goodness, sometime in the 80s, 25 or 30 years ago. Ethan was seated next to me at the banquet, which was a relief, I can tell you, because there are some exceptionally boring lawyers in this country, and I always seem to draw them as my dinner partner at these things. I stared at her, my mouth still open. She seemed delighted that I was so interested. "Ethan was great fun, though. Knowledge about the theater and tennis. He and Betsy would fly over to England for Wimbledon every year. Remember a few summers ago when Dad and I had tickets for Center Court? We talked about how fun it would be if we bumped into the Sinclairs there. But the week before, your father insisted on going out jogging, even though it was raining. And he slipped and broke his ankle, and you never let him forget it. I know, I know." "Well, I just think he should have shown better sense. We had to cancel the whole trip. Non-refundable flights to London." She sniffed. "Anyway, we used to see the Sinclairs every year at the convention. We still trade Christmas cards." My parents must receive 100, maybe 200 holiday cards each December. They display them from tartan ribbons, tied in bows and trailing down from the spindles of the stairs in their front hall. My brothers and I race each other to read aloud the obnoxiously self-congratulatory family newsletters. We never bother to glance at the cards from Dad's professional acquaintances.
You didn't answer me. How do you know Ethan?
My mom was sensing that something was wrong. I raised my hand to shush her.
Hang on. This is important. When did you last see him?
She looked uncomfortable.
It's been years. We stopped going to all those ABA events when your daddy retired. But Ethan called the house just last week.
He what?
Let me think. It was the day I had the girls with me.
The girls would be Haley and Kira, Tony's little girls. Mom counted backward on her fingers.
Last Monday, the 21st.
What did he want?
Caroline, he was just being friendly, just saying hi. He talked about how he was thinking of following your father's lead. Maybe start easing into retirement himself. He asked about you kids.
I felt queasy. Why? Has he ever met us?
No, I don't think so. But why do you have his picture?
She gestured at the coffee table.
And what's he doing standing there with...
Her lip trembled.
I assume that's her. Your birth mother?
Mom, it's okay. I moved to wrap my arm around her. What did you tell him? About me?
Only that you'd grown up into a beautiful young woman, she pleaded. People ask after each other's children, Caroline. It's what parents do. All I said was how proud we are of you and how well you've done teaching at Georgetown, and that you were going to take some time off to have an operation.
I closed my eyes. That Monday was the day Madame Aubuchon had ordered me to take sabbatical for the rest of the semester. Wasn't that the night that Will had slept over? I had already met Sinclair by then. But Leland Brett's follow-up article confirming my plans to get surgery hadn't run until the next day, Tuesday the 22nd. That Monday, it was not yet public knowledge whether the bullet was about to be extracted or whether it would stay in my neck forever. Ethan Sinclair had been checking up on me.
He knows my parents, Beamer.
To hell with last names, with police protocol and professional distance. I was too upset. Sinclair called my mom last week.
Back up. What are you talking about? How could he call your mama?
Not Sadie Rawson, Franny. He knows the Cashins.
What? You sure?
Asked Beamer Beasley down the phone line from Atlanta. My mother, Franny, just recognized him in a photo. She says he called their house last week. He asked about me, Beamer.
All right, hang on. Let me conference in Jerry. You can tell us both what happened.
It took 10 minutes to recount my conversation with my mother. When I had finished, Beasley cleared his throat.
Sinclair and your daddy are both lawyers. Trial attorneys, roughly the same age, at the end of successful careers. I suppose it's not shocking that their paths might have crossed.
My thoughts exactly, said Jerry Fleeman. Makes sense that they would attend the same conventions.
I had liked the head of the Atlanta Police Department's cold case squad when he conducted my formal interview over the phone last week. He seemed smart, competent. Now, from 600 miles away, he was getting on my nerves. There must be, I don't know, 500,000 litigators in the United States, I snapped. It's not like they're all buddies, hanging out and smoking cigars at Ye Old Litigators Club. And to my knowledge, none of the rest of them has been calling my mom in Washington, inquiring after my health. You don't find that a strange coincidence?
Let's think this through calmly, said Jerry. You said your parents originally met Ethan Sinclair because he sat next to your mom at a dinner back in the 1980s. You're not suggesting, what, that he engineered that, are you, as a way of getting to you?
I'm suggesting you consider the possibility.
Ms. Cashin, that would mean he'd been stalking you for the last 30 years, scoffed Jerry. 30 years? If he means you harm, he's certainly taken his time about it.
Fine, not stalking me, but keeping tabs on me. Keeping tabs on whether I was healthy, whether I had remembered anything.
What, with an annual Christmas card swap? I'm sorry, I just don't think. It does make a crazy kind of sense, said Beasley, just when I thought I might scream. Whoever the killer was, he would have wanted to know whether the sole surviving witness remembered anything, and he couldn't just call and ask to speak to a little girl. He would have had to go through her adoptive parents.
Precisely, I said.
But I still don't think Sinclair had anything to do with it, said Beasley. I also don't think he had anything to do with the burglary of your house, Miss Cashin.
Okay, how come?
Because he was at his cabin out on Lake Burton. His wife says they were there together all last week. They're still there. Sounds like she's attempting to persuade him to spend less time at the office.
Where's Lake Burton? I demanded. When did you talk to her?
North Georgia, Rabun County.
Beasley sighed.
You asked me to find out where Sinclair was last Wednesday. I can't say I credit your suspicions about him, but I figured we owed you an answer. Also figured we owed him the courtesy of not hearing secondhand that we're taking another look into the Smith murders. So I called his law firm yesterday. They gave me the phone number for the lake house.
And he's definitely there?
Yes, ma'am. Betsy, that's his wife. She said he'd walked out the door 5 minutes before I called. Out on his boat, fishing all afternoon yesterday. Gray bass fishing up at Burton,
Jerry chimed in,
although getting a little cold for it now. Anyway, if we're done here...
We're not done here, I said, irritated. She could be lying about where he was last week.
Possible, said Beasley evenly. But I had his secretary check his calendar. She agrees he was at the lake house last Wednesday and Thursday.
Did she lay eyes on him there? Or is that just where he told her he...
Beasley cut in, and we checked the flight lists into National Dulles and BWI, all three D.C. area airports. Ethan Sinclair didn't fly to Washington last week.
Maybe he drove.
Also, added Jerry, local police got the fingerprinting results from your house, and we already had Mr. Sinclair's on file from way back. We compared them. No match.
So the man owns a pair of gloves, I exploded. Look, please tell me that one of you is going to follow up. Press Ethan Sinclair on how he happens to know both my families.
I thought we'd already agreed he had good reason to attend the same bar association meetings as Thomas Cashin,
Jerry grumbled. Absolutely, I shot back. But why didn't he mention the connection when he met me for breakfast at the St. Regis? He acted as though he had no idea that the man who adopted me was a lawyer.
I have to agree with her there, said Beasley. I thought of that, too.
Thank you. I relaxed a little in my chair. Meanwhile, any news about the bullet? The lab's had it for 4 days now.
We'll keep hassling them, said Jerry. These things can take time.
After he signed off, Beasley stayed on the line.
Sorry about that. Jerry's a good guy. Skepticism and mistrust are part of the job description.
What about being a complete jerk? Does he throw that in for free? Beasley chuckled.
And I take your point about Sinclair not acknowledging that he knows the Cashins. It's odd. There must be an explanation, but I'll be damned if I can think of it. Maybe I'll drive up today, pay him a visit at his cabin. It'd do me good to get out of the city.
Thank you. One more thing. His alibi, back in 79. Who was it?
On my doorstep stood a woman with flaming red hair. "Hey there, hi, sorry to disturb you," she called through the door, waving a business card in front of her. I couldn't read it through the narrow tunnel of my peephole. "Hello? Rhonda from your office said I would find you here." Rhonda is the administrative assistant for the Faculty of Languages and Linguistics at Georgetown. Cautiously, I cracked the door. "Yes? Thanks. Hi." She trained a warm smile on me. "My name's Alexandra James. I'm a journalist. Wait." She jammed the toe of her boot in the door before I could slam it shut. "I know. Last person you want to talk to, right?" The megawatt smile tipped up at me. "Just hear me out. 2 minutes and I'll go." I studied her face more closely. She looked a few years younger than me, perhaps in her late 20s. She wasn't beautiful, not exactly, but she was striking. Well-dressed. I glanced down. Great legs. "I remember you. You write for that Boston paper, right? You broke the big terrorism story at the White House last year." "Yeah," she grinned, still recovering from that one. "I got this for my troubles." She lifted bangs off her forehead to reveal a thin white scar. Alexandra James had been all over the news herself for a while. She had broken the mother of all stories, had been nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, as I recalled, but questions had been raised about her ethics. Whether she'd crossed red lines in dealing with sources. She was rumored to have slept with a British spy. I couldn't remember the details. "I'm based here in Washington now. I read your story about the bullet and what happened to your family. Were you pleased with how the Journal Constitution handled it?" I was caught off guard. Yes, more or less. "Look, I really..." "Good. I thought the reporter was respectful, the way he wrote about the deaths of Boone and Sadie Rawson Smith. I did wonder, though, I mean, obviously, the AJC's an Atlanta operation, they're going to want to play up the Atlanta story, but I did wish they had also interviewed your family here, the Cashins." "Oh, we don't want any more publicity. Can't say I blame you, but it would be nice, you know? To hear from the family that you grew up with. They got sidelined by the story the way it was written. Left out. Kind of a shame, because if I read between the lines correctly, it sounds like you're close. I'd love to see a story where you had the opportunity to thank them. Talk about how much they mean to you." A shrewd pitch. She had zeroed in on the one angle I'd be happy to talk about all day. "Anyway," the smile again. "I promised to shut up after 2 minutes. May I leave you my card? My cell number's on it in case you ever want to talk." I accepted the ivory rectangle from her outstretched hand, intending to chuck it in the trash the second she left. "Oh," she twirled around. "I almost forgot. Here, for your convalescence." Alexandra James held up a white box tied with string. I recognized the elaborate cursive P of the Pâtisserie Poupon logo. My eyes narrowed. "How did you..." "Like I said, I called the university before I walked over here, to check when they were expecting you back at work. I didn't want to disturb you if you'd just been released from the hospital an hour ago or something." "And Rhonda gave out my home address?" I would need to have a word with her. No, I already had it. You're in the phone book, you know. Rhonda didn't tell me anything except that you're on leave for the rest of the semester, and that if you weren't at home, I might find you here." She tapped the P logo on the pastry box. "I share your addiction, by the way. I'm a fiend for their lemon tart." I bit back a smile. Say what you would about the woman's journalistic ethics. She was clever. I carried the box through to my kitchen. Lifted the lid. Bacon quiche, still warm. You are not supposed to accept food from strangers. That must be one of the earliest lessons that my mother, hell, probably both my mothers, had drummed into me. but they also taught me to trust my instincts. Right now, mine were telling me that Alex James wanted to interview me, not poison me. I opened a drawer and pulled out a fork. I had powered my way through two slices of quiche and was eyeing a third when the doorbell rang again. What now? It was a tiny skeleton. In plump hands, it clutched a hollow plastic pumpkin. Trick or treat! I had forgotten it was Halloween. Bizarre holiday. Dressing children up as witches and vampires, telling them stories about monsters and ghosts. As if real life didn't pack enough nasty surprises. 41. Friday, November 1st, 2013. For many years, if you wanted to make a phone call in Atlanta, you were routed through the switchboards of Southern Bell. In the early days, the 1880s, the only long-distance call you could place was from Atlanta to Decatur, 6 whole miles away. That would set you back 15 cents for a 5-minute chat. It was 1915 before the first transcontinental call, voices dancing from the East Coast to the West, across thousands of miles of suspended copper wire. 1951, before you were allowed to dial long distance without the assistance of an operator. 1956, before the first transatlantic phone cable was laid. Southern Bell thrived through the changes, survived a dizzying number of mergers and spin-offs and splits, until the company name was finally retired in 1998. I mention all of this by way of backdrop. Backdrop to what, for our purposes, is by far the most interesting date in Southern Bell's corporate history, March 25th, 1971. That's when a Mr. Verlin Snow walked through the doors. He was hired as a senior vice president, poached from a Boston bank, 45 years old. Technically, he was brought in to oversee the completion of the transition to touch-tone phones. They'd been available to subscribers since the early 60s, but folks seemed slow to catch on. But Snow's real talent was as a rainmaker. He possessed an exceptional knack for greasing political connections to increase profits. A columnist for the Atlanta Business Chronicle noted that most weekdays you could watch him in action at the Coach and Six, the Peachtree Street power lunch spot favored by the city's old guard. Verlin Snow stood out, the columnist added with a trace of suspicion, not only for his Yankee accent, but for his puritanical habits. Snow conducted business stone-cold sober, in a town where most men were disposed toward downing a second martini before the food arrived. Sometime in the late 1970s, though, he had gotten into trouble. He had hired a young lawyer by the name of Ethan Sinclair, a rising star in one of Atlanta's white shoe firms. I couldn't tell quite what kind of trouble Snow was in. Beamer Beasley didn't seem to know either, and whatever it was, Sinclair appeared to have earned his fee and succeeded at making it disappear. A Forbes magazine profile of Snow in 1981, the man who killed off the rotary phone, alluded only to an extended leave of absence, taken at his summer home on Nantucket, from which Snow had returned to work, energized and more bullish than ever. What Beasley did know was that late in 1979, when Sinclair was questioned about the murders of Boone and Sadie Rawson Smith, he had had an impeccable alibi. He had been locked in a conference room at his downtown office, conferring with his client, Verlin Snow. Snow confirmed this when police followed up. Yes, he was absolutely certain about the date and hours in question. No, Sinclair could not have slipped out for any length of time. Lawyer and client had been hunkered over stacks of documents, heads bowed together the entire afternoon. Snow was a pillar of the business community, a member of the Wright Country Club, on the executive committee of the Commerce Club. His word was gold. I was able to piece together most of Verlin Snow's background from my kitchen table. Astonishing what you can accomplish these days, armed with a laptop and a fast internet connection. But the press clippings petered out after his retirement in the early 90s. He was quoted a few times, trotted out for expert analysis in news stories covering various telecom antitrust lawsuits. The last reference I could find was from 1997, 16 years ago, when the student newspaper for Northwestern University mentioned that Snow would be guest lecturing at the Kellogg Graduate School of Management. I couldn't tell where he might be now. I couldn't tell if he'd kept in touch with Ethan Sinclair, or if he knew anything that might help me. I couldn't even tell if Verlin Snow was still alive. It came to me when I stood to put the kettle on and warm the last piece of bacon quiche in the microwave. Snow's summer house, Nantucket. Finding him turned out to be easy. On my laptop, an address and a phone number for a V.R. Snow in Nantucket, Massachusetts, popped right up. When I dialed, no one answered. I speared a bite of quiche, chewed, and tried again. Let it ring 7 times. 8, 9.
Hello?
Said a surprised-sounding voice, the way one would answer a phone that rarely rang. Hi, I'm calling from Washington, trying to reach a Mr. Verlin Snow. Do I have the right number? A longish pause. Yes, said the voice, still surprised. A woman. This is Caroline Cashin. May I speak to him, please?
But he can't speak on the phone, she said, now indignant, as if this were an obvious point that I had stubbornly been resisting.
Her accent was Caribbean, possibly Jamaican. You mean not right now? Might he be available later?
No, Mr. Snow's not well. What did you say your name was?
Sorry, let me back up. My name is Caroline. I was hoping to come see Mr. Snow. I was surprised to hear my voice forming these words. Maybe tomorrow.
Oh, no, 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 came the reply, now stern. I wouldn't think so. He doesn't see visitors anymore.
Her voice dropped to a whisper.
He's an invalid. Did you not know? Cancer of the throat.
I had done the math before I called. Verlin Snow would be 87 years old. I dropped my voice to match hers.
Can he still hear well enough? Can he understand questions? Yes.
Okay. Tell him something for me. Tell him Caroline Cashin is on the phone. When I was a girl, my name was Caroline Smith. Tell him it's regarding a lawyer from Atlanta named Ethan Sinclair, about the time they spent together in November 1979. The woman was gone a good 5 minutes. I could hear pipes running in the background and the barking of a distant dog. When she came back on the line, she said simply,
"He'll see you. He's best in the afternoons."
There are no direct flights from Washington to Nantucket, not in the off-season. I would have to fly through Boston, connecting onto a 10-seat puddle jumper flown by Cape Air. Still, if I left early tomorrow, I could be on the island by 11 a.m., New England weather permitting. I reached up to finger the stitches on my neck as I clicked around travel websites. Dr. Gellert would kill me if he knew what I was contemplating. Beamer Beasley would, too, for a completely different set of reasons. Booking flights on small planes, booking any travel at all a mere 7 days after emergency surgery was stupid, I had to admit. But as I hesitated, I noticed that I was holding the computer mouse in my right hand. I had not been able to do that for the past year. I'd made the switch back without even realizing it. Something else felt different, too. I think I've mentioned that I'm not known for rash decisions, am not a taker of spur-of-the-moment trips. Yet here I sat, about to buy a ticket for a plane that left in 11 hours to fly to an island that I'd never seen to meet a stranger. I should have felt nervous, but instead I felt invigorated. Sometime in the chaos of these last few weeks, I appeared to have developed a taste for recklessness. I hovered my hand, my right hand, above the mouse. Then I swooped down and clicked on the box that said purchase. My mobile buzzed as I brushed my teeth before bed. I picked right up. One of my post-will resolutions was to be more vigilant about answering my phone. Another was not to fall for any man who listened to country or wore bootcut jeans. Also, never again to accept a date that involved baseball. Although, in fairness, I might have arrived at that particular fatwa, even if Will Zartman had turned out to be a good guy.
Everything okay? You safe?
It was Beamer Beasley. Yes, I spat toothpaste into the sink. Why?
Good. In for the night. Alarm on, doors locked.
Beamer, what's going on?
Just checking. Just that I can't, at this exact moment, I can't locate Ethan Sinclair.
I laid the floss back beside the sink and plopped down on the edge of the bathtub. What do you mean you can't locate him? I thought he was up at that lake. Lake Burton.
Well, that's it. I drove up there yesterday like I said I would, for a number of reasons, but frankly, the main one was I thought it might put your mind at ease. Figured I could talk to him, let him explain some of the inconsistencies I know have been troubling you. But he wasn't there. I talked to his wife.
Betsy.
That's right. A nice lady.
So she was at the cabin?
Yes, actually. Cabin, my rear end, snorted Beasley. It's not a cabin, it's a compound they've got up there. Boathouse with room for two motorboats, a sailboat, a couple canoes, you name it. Plus 100 yards of private shoreline, even a barn so Mrs. Sinclair can ride her horses. Anyway, she was real polite. But she said I'd missed him again. Mr. Sinclair had to drive back into town to take care of some business. She'd said he'd be at his office, but he never turned up at the law firm today, and nobody's home at their house in Buckhead either. His cell phone's turned off. If I were the worrying type, I'd be starting to worry that he's avoiding me.
I could think of half a dozen places where Ethan Sinclair might be, none of them necessarily sinister. His tennis club, a friend's house, the movies. Maybe he had a woman on the side that Betsy didn't know about. If Cheryl was to be believed, he hadn't been a stickler for fidelity 35 years ago. Who knew if the leopard had changed its spots? Thanks for letting me know.
I'll keep trying, said Beasley. He'll turn up. We'll get this all straightened out. Are D.C. police still driving by your house every night?
No, I frowned. Not since last week. Not since my surgery. I mean, the bullet's gone. There is no reason anyone would feel threatened by me anymore, right?
Speaking of that, the bullet, that was the other thing I called to tell you. They can't do anything with it.
Nothing at all? My voice rose in dismay.
Not here in Atlanta. They did identify the caliber. It's a .38 special. Full metal jacket, which explains why the bullet passed through your mama's body and onto you. So the firearm in question would have been a revolver. I'm guessing maybe a Smith & Wesson .38 special. That's what we all used to carry. Standard service cartridge for police departments for many years.
Jesus, I shrieked. You don't mean the police were involved?
No, no, that's not what I meant. Cops carried them, but so did plenty of other folks. They're good guns, work well for everything from personal defense to target practice to popping off rabbits in your backyard. People still buy 'em. The trouble is,
Beasley sighed.
Ms. Cashin, the trouble is your bullet from your neck isn't in good enough condition to make a comparison. It's scored in several places, scratched up. Maybe from back when it was fired, maybe from where the surgeon used tweezers to tug at it to get it out.
I felt as though I'd been punched in the stomach.
We're shipping it up to Virginia, to the FBI. They've got 100 times the manpower and expertise we do.
The FBI? The FBI is going to examine my bullet? I repeated incredulously.
Best crime lab in the country. Out in Quantico, literally hundreds of firearms specialists, ammo specialists, forensic techs, special agents, you name it.
Did you send the FBI the evidence bullets, too? The sample ones that you all kept from 1979?
Yes, of course. That's the whole point.
Were any of them 38 caliber?
Listen, let's cross that bridge when we get there, okay? I've already bent the rules, telling you this much.
But Beamer,
Ms. Cashin, I'm hanging up now. We should hear back from Quantico by early next week.
After that, I tried to sleep, but every few minutes some noise snapped me awake. A shutter on my neighbor's house was loose and banging in the wind. Somewhere farther up the block, a car alarm went off. When an owl hooted outside my window shortly after 2 a.m., I nearly jumped out of my skin. I checked the settings on the burglar alarm, checked the deadbolt on my bedroom door, then got dressed and waited until it was time to call a taxi for the airport. Part 4. Nantucket. 42. Saturday, November 2, 2013. Verlin Snow's house was big and square and built of weathered gray clapboard. But then, from what I could see through the rain-streaked windows of the airport taxi, all the houses on Nantucket were built of weathered gray clapboard. I had never seen such uniform architecture. My initial impressions of the island were of billowing fog and gusting wind, the air split by the shriek of seagulls and sharp with the tang of brine. There was also the smell of money. The streets were swept, the gardens tended, wet roses curling over freshly painted picket fences, even in November. I endured the drive from the airport with gritted teeth, one hand pressed to the back of my bruised neck, the other braced against the car door. This morning's back-to-back flights had been smooth. I had wrapped a soft, thick shawl around my shoulders and slept the whole way. But Nantucket's uneven cobblestone streets were torture. The taxi jounced and splashed through puddles, past coffee shops, an old-fashioned pharmacy, a bank, a pretty church. Half the shops looked closed for winter. The sidewalks were deserted. The Snow House sat near the center of what appeared to be the biggest town on the island, known with typical New England austerity simply as Town. After a couple of blocks, the storefronts on Main Street gave way to great mansions, the former homes of sea captains and whaling merchants. Seagulls aside, Nantucket's Main Street bore a remarkable resemblance to the swankier blocks of Georgetown.
"Here we go,"
said the driver, drawing up near the corner of Main and Milk Streets. Glass lanterns burned on either side of 3 stone steps and an imposing front door. The brass knocker and letter slot gleamed. I pulled a box of Advil out of my handbag, popped 3 pills, knocked, and waited. When the door swung open,
The scene was more or less as I had imagined. A dimly lit foyer, fussily furnished but clean. Old rugs, old Audubon bird prints, faded wallpaper. A grandfather clock that looked as if it hadn't kept time for generations. The woman with the Caribbean accent was friendlier and more soft-spoken in person than she had been on the phone. She introduced herself as Marie. I couldn't tell if she was a friend or a nurse or a housekeeper or some combination of the above. She took my dripping coat and led me past darkened rooms. "He can't talk anymore," she whispered. "Not for months now. But his mind's sharp as a tack. How does he... He writes. I've tried to get him to use the computer, but he prefers his notepad. You'll see." She glanced at me from the corner of her eye. "I was surprised he allowed you to come. He doesn't bother with most folks anymore. Says they wear him out. But he got up and shaved this morning for you." At the back of the house was an unexpectedly cheerful sitting room. A fire blazed at one end, and before it, in one of those mammoth corduroy lazy boy recliners favored by old people, sat a man. He pushed the chair upright when I entered and rose to shake my hand. Snow was stooped and shriveled, and didn't look as if he'd been tall to begin with. The top of his scaly bald head barely reached my chin. His skin was sallow, and flecks of dried blood dotted his jaw, casualties from his attempt at a morning shave. I felt a wave of pity, imagining him splashing at the sink, the effort it must have required. Snow gestured for me to sit. He lined his own heels up against the edge of the recliner, stuck out his bottom, and allowed himself to fall backward into the deep chair, the way I remembered my grandmother doing after she got too frail to sit and stand on her own. Snow and I studied each other. He might be in the advanced stages of cancer, but his eyes were clear and lucid, intelligent. Marie was right. His mind seemed sharp as a tack. "Thank you for seeing me. Do you know why I'm here?" He reached toward a wooden side table between us. On it lay a pen and a brown moleskin notebook. "How do you do?" he wrote, then met my eye and nodded formally. On the next line, in a spidery scrawl, "Why don't you tell me?" So I did. I told him about what had happened to the Smiths in the house on Eulalia Road. About how I had been raised in another city by another family and had only recently learned of the existence of my first family. About how I had lived almost my entire life with a bullet inside my neck. He appeared to listen closely, scratching out the occasional exclamation point at dramatic moments in my narrative, and once a question mark when he seemed to want me to elaborate. "They never caught my parents' killer," I concluded. "But you know one of the people who was questioned. He was your lawyer." Snow nodded and wrote, "Ethan." "You told the police that you were with him all that afternoon." Another nod. "Was that true?" The intelligent eyes held mine. His hand rested motionless on the notebook. That had been too abrupt a way to ask. I needed to come at the question more subtly. But I felt impatient, and the stitches on my neck itched, and this room felt stiflingly hot. "Mr. Sinclair came to see me a couple of weeks ago." I tried again. Berlin Snow had no eyebrows, but the wrinkles on his forehead wiggled in a way that suggested he would have raised his eyebrows if he could. "He was kind, but some of the things he said, or rather, things he chose not to say, don't make sense to me." I leaned forward and placed my hand on Snow's emaciated knee. "One other thing that you should know. I was attacked in my house in Washington one night last week.
Someone tried to hurt me. I think it was someone who knew that the bullet in my neck posed a threat to them. Someone who knew it could send them to prison. Snow's forehead contracted in a spasm of wrinkles. !! he wrote. Please help me. Still, his eyes held mine. I don't care why you had to hire Ethan Sinclair as your attorney. I don't care what kind of trouble you were in. That's not why I'm here. I squeezed Snow's knee hard. That day, the day my parents died, could Ethan Sinclair have been at their house? You swore it was impossible, that the two of you were locked up together in a conference room. Verlin Snow picked up the pen. Slowly, in cramped, shaky letters, he wrote, I lied. 43. I pried the moleskin notebook from Snow's hands, rotated it so I could read right side up, ran my finger over his words. I lied. You weren't with him then, that afternoon. He took back the notebook and wrote, part. Meaning what? You were with him part of the time, but not the whole afternoon. A tired nod. So he has no alibi, I whispered. He never did. He could have been at Boone and Sadie Rawson's house. Snow flinched and scribbled furiously, I don't know that. He underlined the words, four heavy lines. Okay, you don't know where he was, only that he wasn't with you. Rapid nodding, I narrowed my eyes. You lied for him. Lied to police in a murder investigation. And you never bothered to ask where he really was? How could you not be curious? What did the guy have on you? This was met with a shrug. Why did you lie? If I was not mistaken, Snow rolled his eyes. I suppose that you don't think it matters at this point, but Mr. Snow, my voice tightened with rage. Mr. Snow, my parents died. I was shot. If Ethan Sinclair did that, if he was there, he shot a 3-year-old girl and left her to bleed to death. You must have heard about it. You must have seen the newspaper account. How could you live with yourself? How could you lie for him? All at once, Verlin Snow lurched forward in his seat and made a grotesque, rasping noise, halfway between a croak and a howl. He made it again and then was seized by a fit of coughing. I leapt to my feet and searched the room for a glass of water or a tissue. Nothing. Should I find Marie? But he was quieting now, clutching his chest, tears and snot rolling down his wasted face. He wiped his face on his sleeve and groped around for the pen. He wrote steadily for several minutes before looking up and pushing the notebook across to me. I was sued. Insider trading, securities fraud. I would have lost everything. Fought back. But pretrial discovery turned up evidence. Record of phone call typed by my secretary. Ethan required to turn it over. You see? But that night, Ethan came to me. He said, help me, I'll help you. I destroy phone note if you say I was with you. Easy. No email then. Long time ago. No electronic document trails. Just the one piece of paper. So he burned it, and I told police we spent that day in the conference room. A win-win. I finished reading and looked up in astonishment. He turned to a clean page and wrote, I'm not proud. I should think not. Assumed it was about a woman. He needed excuse for his wife, for where he'd been. Ethan was always ladies' man. And what do you think now? My voice was like ice. Ladies' man, he underlined it. Not a murderer. You don't know that. That's the point. You don't know where he was, what he did that day.
Another shrug. I need you to make a statement. Tell the police what you've told me. There's an old detective, Sergeant Beasley, who knows this case well.
Snow shook his head. He wrote, "Goodbye, Caroline."
With that, he tore the pages from the binding, everything that he had written, crumpled, and threw them into the fire. The edges caught. Blue flames licked up. Within moments, the pages were ashes.
I breathed in sharply. I can type up what you've told me. All you need to do is sign your name at the bottom, just the part about Ethan not being with you. Nobody cares about the rest of it anymore. The statute of limitations has probably run out anyway on the insider trading charge.
But Verlin Snow had closed his eyes and sunk back into the lazy boy. He looked tiny and old and ill.
Mr. Snow,
I tapped his leg.
Mr. Snow.
He opened his eyes to a slit, whacked my hand away from his thigh. His lips made no noise but formed themselves into an unmistakable round O.
No, he said, as distinctly as if he'd actually spoken the word aloud.
The eyes snapped back shut.
I found my coat where Marie had hung it behind the stairs and let myself out.
Nantucket in late fall is like a ghost town, a silvery, misty, freezing, prosperous ghost town. I trudged through drizzle from Verlin Snow's house, back past the church on Main Street, then left and up Center Street. My flight out was not until tomorrow morning, 9:05 a.m., so I'd booked at a bed and breakfast for the night. In the room, I scrubbed my face with hot water, kicked off my boots, curled up on the bed, and slept again. 4 dreamless hours. When I woke, it was dark. I threw off the blanket and wondered how a hotel room could manage to feel both boiling hot and dankly damp at once. I needed to get out. The boy, minding the front desk, looked barely old enough to drive. Judging from the full wall of keys behind him, I might be the only guest tonight. He spent a minute reeling off the names of restaurants I should come back in high season to try, and another minute singing the praises of a bar at the tip of the island, if only I had a car to get there.
Just somewhere close, I pleaded. Close and open would be good. My standards aren't high tonight.
Brotherhood of Thieves is 30 seconds that way, he pointed. Walk out the front door, you're on Broad Street, turn left, and you're there. It's an old whaling bar.
Perfect.
Awesome beer on tap. Try the Cisco Ale, or the seasonal Pumple Drumpkin, if they've still got it. Brewed here on Nantucket. They add chunks of pumpkin and spices. Awesome.
That sounded perfectly vile, but I refrained from saying so. Brotherhood of Thieves was dark, with low timbered ceilings and a roaring fire. Lanterns hung from brick walls. Only 2 tables were occupied, one by an awkward couple who appeared to be on a date, another by 4 old men who had the air of regulars. 2 empty beer pitchers sat stickily on the table between them, and a third looked well on its way to being guzzled. I squeezed into a seat at the bar, caught the bartender's eye, and started to order my usual glass of dry white wine, then reconsidered.
Double bullet, please. Neat.
Nice. He pushed a bowl of pretzels my way.
I held a menu up to a candle to read in the dark. For once, I could not face meat.
What are quahogs?
Clams.
Ah. I'll take a bowl of the island quahog chowder, then.
Good choice. Top you up.
He dangled the bullet bottle above my glass. I glanced down. I had already drained my double.
Yes, why not? And a glass of water.
I should go easy. Neither Will Zartman nor my brothers were here to carry me home tonight.
My heart twisted at the thought of Will. The last time I'd been in a bar was the Georgia Grill, the night he surprised me in Atlanta. I held a sip of rye on my tongue and closed my eyes, and remembered how it had felt when he touched me, when he had drawn his circles on my wrist, my collarbone, my breast. How difficult it was to breathe when he pressed his hips against mine. When I opened my eyes, the bartender was placing chowder and a packet of oyster crackers in front of me.
Bowl's hot. Watch yourself.
I took a spoonful. It was peppery and creamy and rich. The old men had a fresh pitcher on their table. The beer was a light straw yellow. They were steering clear of the pumple drumkin, too. The couple had gone. On the TV above the bar were pictures of a jubilant crowd waving Red Sox banners. Confetti filled the air behind them.
Did the Red Sox win again?
I asked the bartender.
Did they win again? Where have you been? They won the World Series this week. That's the victory parade today in Boston.
He leaned sideways to watch. The screen showed a caravan of duck boats rolling down a street in Boston, Red Sox players riding on top and whooping. They were still sporting their lucky beards, and when I looked closely, I noticed many of the duck boats had been decorated with matching caveman-style whiskers. A band started up playing God Bless America. The camera panned to a small girl dancing in the street, her face painted and her blonde hair streaked with Red Sox red, vuvuzelas and car horns braid.
Boston strong, said the bartender, thumping his chest. Boston strong, called the stoutest of the old men.
They all clinked smeary glasses at the TV.
On the house, said the bartender, pouring me what looked at least a triple.
He turned around to grin at the stout old man.
Hey, hey, here we go. What do you say, Marty? I think Ortiz and the boys may be going for a swim.
The caravan of amphibious duck boats had turned off the street to make a victory lap in the Charles River. I sipped my whiskey and watched the men watch the Red Sox. Such simple things can produce such joy. Tomorrow I would have to think about what Verlyn Snow had told me. About Ethan Sinclair, about Sadie Rawson and Boone, about what it all meant. Tonight, I allowed myself to sit in a dark bar with a bunch of happy old men, and to believe that the world might be a decent place after all.
Part 5. Washington. 44. Sunday, November 3rd, 2013. I felt fine the next day. It helped that the clocks had changed during the night, buying everyone an extra hour in bed. Or perhaps I was still drunk. 7 shots of rye and I had slept like a baby, my best night's sleep in weeks. On the plane home, I popped 2 Advil to relax my neck muscles. Liver failure, here I come, and devoured both the Boston Globe and the New York Times. It had been weeks since I'd focused on the news. Politicians who I didn't even know were sick had died. The United Nations was warning of genocide in the Central African Republic. Twitter was about to go public. Amy Tan had a new book out. I read the headlines with the curiosity of someone who has been at sea for weeks.